the more people kind of have this inner critic in their mind, the more they end up, they will continually be reinforcing it, you know, by in fact trying to like obey it. So obeying the inner critic is not the path to peace, but getting rid of the inner critic is not an option either. So the solution is you have to learn to approach the critic in a new way.
Before we get started, if you enjoy these episodes, you might want to explore more at optimorg.com. Our website offers unique content, tools, and exercises to help you thrive at work and beyond. We have an in-depth masterclass which covers our entire theory of growth. We have daily recommendations for personalized advice, and we have a platform to help groups and organizations learn and practice optimal work together. You can get a free trial at optimorg.com. Now let's get started with today's episode. Hey, this is Sharif here with another episode of the Optimal Work Podcast, joined by Dr. Kevin Majors. Kevin, great to be back here with you again.
Hey, Sharif, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, of course, Kevin. Well, you're always welcome back on the show. As people know, the last three episodes we've done have been on three stages of anxiety, and that's part of that has been produced by you working on a new course on anxiety, which is fantastic, and it's turning out awesome. And I think one of the concepts you were playing around in the course of developing that was shame and the role of shame to anxiety. And I think, you know, one topic that we don't cover, that Optimal Work is very relevant to, but we don't mention the word very much, is motivation, which I think is very common in discussions of work. It's like, how do we get our employees motivated, or how do I get motivated to do this task that I don't want to do? So I'd love to get your thoughts on, you know, shame in the context of work and motivation. And then I know also we've been talking about IFS, and I've been looking into that a little bit more, internal mm-hmm. family systems, right? And I know that applies to this discussion of shame and motivation as well. So it's kind of like, I like to tie together these three ideas of shame, motivation, and IFS.
Yeah, that's okay. That's a lot to try to unite. Let me see if
it's
I can
do it. It's a tall order. Yeah.
Yes. Anxiety is the urge to avoid challenge. Okay. So whenever we detect a challenge, then it's natural that part of us will treat that challenge as a threat to be avoided. And we get this urge then to avoid the challenge. And if we do, it confirms that it was a real threat. And now it becomes even more threatening, and we have a stronger urge to avoid it the next time. So that's how threat learning takes place. Now, shame relates to anxiety in an interesting way. Shame is a species of anxiety or fear. And particularly, it's the anxiety we have about being somehow disgraced in the eyes of others. So it's the social component that either real or imagined. It could be that, you know, there's people have their own internal critic many times. And so there's always an audience of some kind. And when we feel shame, we feel like, oh, this is, now I'm looking bad in front of others. It's one of the earliest forms of anxiety that we can have. So it's the, you know, children feel it when it comes to letting their parents down or somehow disappointing their parents or displeasing them. So shame is a deep and primordial form of anxiety. And it is, I think, it's essential to understanding unwillingness. Like our unwillingness to confront challenge and our unwillingness to grow is just deeply tied to our unwillingness to experience shame. And being on a learning curve, doing new things, getting better at things can feel shame-provoking or embarrassing. So that's why we often don't do things that stretch us and it gets us out of our comfort zone. So I see shame as a very potent force, a kind of anxiety that is specifically aimed at blocking our growth, because it blocks us from allowing to go through the awkward stages of getting better at something. So why don't we learn new languages? Well, we're afraid to speak them because we don't want to look bad. Not that we consciously say that, but it's just there. Or why do some people think, well, I just can't do math? Well, because getting through the stages of learning how to do particular kinds of math problems, they might find embarrassing, you know, and so they shy away from it. So I think that shame is just the deepest part of what I would call the structure of unwillingness within us. And willingness I see as motivation. Willingness is motivation in a person who is fully free. It's free to to set their own goals for themselves. So, and that means being willing to then embrace the discomfort that will come along the way as they go up that learning curve. And so I see willingness and unwillingness as these two sides, and shame is all about why we're unwilling to stretch ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So
how does that sound? Does that kind of unite what you were hoping to?
Yeah. That's the first two, shame and motivation. I think we can dig into that a little bit deeper as well. I just have, you know, some follow-up questions. So with shame, so you mentioned that it's kind of a demotivator. It's like, I'm not going to take on these new challenges that might stretch me or force me to learn and grow in new ways. So would you say that any time there's reluctance to take on a new challenge, that there's shame in some way, like that someone can, if someone is self-examining themselves, say, and they notice, okay, I was reluctant to engage this challenge, should that be like a bell goes off, okay, there's shame involved and I should look for that shame? Or are there other factors that might be at play here as well?
I would think that there must be other factors at play, and because people could be in a state where they're just feeling overwhelmed and they have too many things to do right now. And so taking on some new learning, they might feel they just don't have the energy it would take. But even then, many times people are afraid of the awkwardness at getting better at saying no. You know, and even saying no, like say your boss is giving you way too many things to do. And if you have trouble saying no, then you might be curious about why is it so hard for me to say no? And if you're afraid of disappointing the boss, that's now you're in the neighborhood of shame. So the fear of disappointing others, the fear of looking bad in the eyes of others, you might think, well, I just don't want to lose my job. But even then, many times, why are you afraid of losing the job? Well, because it'll be kind of embarrassing for all the people in my life to know that I lost a job. So I think that there can be a sense where this is very pervasive. If you start asking, going down a little deeper into, well, why is this so challenging? Why is this so hard? Many times it comes down to, it would just be embarrassing or shameful to go through this kind of learning.
Before we continue, a brief message. If you're benefiting from these discussions, please hit like and subscribe to our channel. Doing so helps us reach more people. So you're not just learning yourself, you're helping others discover a path to growth and flourishing too. Thanks so much for your support. Enjoy the rest of the episode. Is that also connected with fear of failure? Like, is that something you say? Yeah. I'm scared of failing. So there's always a sense of...
I think this is like, because failure is a surefire way of provoking shame. So, and you can see the freedom people get when they lose the fear of failure. So if people get good at challenging themselves regularly, you know, say like, you know, I remember this one patient I had, I might have mentioned him before, who every single month he would be applying and interviewing for another job. Even though he liked the job he was in, but he just had this thing. He wanted to stay in shape, and almost all the time he wouldn't get those jobs because they were just outside his reach. But then occasionally he would get the job that was just outside his reach. So he had no fear of failure. He's like, I'm just going to stay good at the process of being interviewed. And then he was able to do several jumps in his career to be the vice president of a very large multinational company by the time he was like 29. So he did extremely well, but it's because he just leaned into failure. And the idea is, he just wanted to be testing himself to see, what am I capable of? What if I keep stretching? So it seems to me like, now, who knows? That whole thing could be motivated by trying to build a fortress against feelings of inadequacy and shame. So, like, you know, there's, you could never just look at someone attaining outcomes and know why they're doing it, or is it for the best reason? But it's just interesting that when we lose the fear of failing, all these opportunities start to open up to us.
Yeah. So it seems like the dichotomy between intrinsic motivation and extrinsic motivation is another way of putting this, that someone with a fear of failure, a fear of shame, is kind of motivated extrinsically by things outside of them, outcomes outside of them, other people's opinions. Whereas what you're proposing here is really intrinsic motivation. And is that a fair way of restating your points? Or
yeah, but I think that willingness, one, appeals more to the intelligence. So if I was totally willing to grow in a particular way, then it raises the question, like, I would be strategizing. I would have initiative. There would be signs of this willingness. So I see willingness as a creative force in our life. So when we're truly willing to grow, then we start looking creatively at new ways of doing that. And we give ourselves permission to try things and fail. So there's a lot more allowing then for being on the learning curve. I think willingness also means that you're willing to, in a sense, pay the price that that growth would take. So, like, if someone's trying to, say, stop some habit that they think is bad, they can set a goal in their mind then of, like, thinking, what do I want to be like when this habit is totally out of my life? And then they need willingness to embrace the discomfort that will come in shaping themselves in that way. So between where we are now and the growth we're capable of, there is some positive effort that will be needed, for sure, but a lot of it is just being willing to accept the discomfort along the way. So willingness has this idea that motivation doesn't have, that it's open to all of reality, the positive and the negative, will be pleasant, will be unpleasant, so that we can set our sights in I think, the most reasonable way. Willingness actually is what leads to real growth. Unwillingness has like 1,000 deceptions. When it's like we are apparently forgetful, or we just don't notice something, you know, or we think, oh, I'll do that later, or we procrastinate. So unwillingness takes all these forms that in some way they deceive us. You know, and I think that is, that would be the toughest thing, like to blind ourselves to being able to see opportunities, but that's what unwillingness does. And I see shame as the main driver of unwillingness.
Mm-hmm. So earlier when we were talking about shame, you mentioned the idea of self-concepts and shame,
mm-hmm.
that there's a way when we engage challenge, we're kind of bumping up against a self-concept that we think this kind of growth is just out of bounds for me. I'm just not the type of person who takes on this form of challenge. What role are self-concepts playing, you know, regarding shame and limiting our approach of new yeah. challenges?
I think of self-concepts as being defenses against shame. So the self-concepts, if you're going to think of them more globally, then it's the self-image that we have. And all of us in some way craft a self-image that is the social persona. And I think we just have to have it, because when you say, I don't know, go, when you go to a restaurant and you think of how you treat the staff in the restaurant, well, you're not going to want to have to, I don't know, you're just going to have a typical persona that you have. You have a typical way of doing things. It's a way of economizing. And so, and the people around us, we have a typical way of interacting with them. So all of that is kind of the social persona. So I'm not saying that this is even like optional. I think that we're going to have it in some way, no matter what. But that is like, I think, essentially the self-image that we try projecting to others. But that self-image can, in a sense, take on more and more life of its own if we become protectors of it. So we're trying to, or we feel limited by it, or we just don't see ourselves as capable of doing something that others around us are encouraging us to do. Like, Now, to take an example, learning how to dance, how to do a certain kind of dancing. So that's where, like, if your self-image, if there's dissonance that, you know, in your self-image when you think about learning how to do that, well, then you're going to feel like this huge urge, you know, to not do anything that would violate the self-image. And you're like, no, I just don't dance. Whereas if you could be less protective of the self-image and be like, well, let's just see how this goes. What's the learning curve like? How can I get on a trajectory of getting better at dancing? You would get better and better and better at dancing. So, and no matter what kind of style of dance it is. And then your self-image would update. So we can't help but have a model of ourself. So the brain, the left brain in particular, is always modeling the world, including and especially us. So we can't help but have that self-model. But we just don't want to allow it to throw up roadblocks. I'm not saying everyone should dance, but everyone should feel the freedom that if they wanted to learn it, they could.
Mm-hmm. So maybe now we could get into how to work on all of these things. I think we have a great view of like what's going on here with shame and motivation or willingness and self-concepts. If someone is listening to this and identifying very much, oh yeah, I have this self-concept and this challenge I'm avoiding, and afraid of embarrassing myself in this way or failing in this way, you know, how do we start to work on these things?
Yeah, so the more unwilling we are to feel shame, the more we need strategies to prevent it and strategies to escape it. So that is what gives rise in us then to this kind of threefold structure. There's the shame itself, which is then exiled from our experience as far as possible. We try to get away from it. But then to prevent it, we need an internal way of managing ourselves. And then to escape it, we need something that we, like some kind of way of handling the situation if shame is suddenly provoked. So there's a lot of variety then in prevention strategies and escape strategies. But if you're unwilling to experience shame or actually any emotion, you will have both of those. Your brain has to come up with ways of doing that. So, and they can have such force that we experience them as perhaps our, like, automation or as a voice in our head. I'm not talking about schizophrenia or, you know, when people actually are hearing voices, but the most common voice people hear in their head is the inner critic. You know, we've done episode on the inner critic in the past, and all of this, I think, will fit exactly with what we said there, that the inner critic is the most common way that people stay on guard so as not to accidentally trigger shame. So the critic is warning them, you know, and sometimes using shame, which is the funny, ironic part, shaming the person so that they don't have more shame, giving them a little foretaste of what shame is like, you know, and like, you know, like, you idiot, you're so stupid. Like, why do you do this? And but the idea is that to prevent even more shame from somehow being triggered if the critic didn't swoop in. And so the more people kind of have this inner critic in their mind, the more they end up, they will continually be reinforcing it, you know, by in fact trying to like obey it. So obeying the inner critic is not the path to peace, but getting rid of the inner critic is not an option either. So the solution is you have to learn to approach the critic in a new way. And that's what IFS does. IFS is internal family systems, and it's simply a way that we can deliberately interact with our brain's models for how to handle certain challenges. So like the inner critic is an example of a kind of personified strategy for avoiding shame, but it doesn't have to be the critic. It could be the inner coach or inner expert or therapist, or it could be like a kind of inner a persona that's more like an overachiever or a hyper-responsible part. So it can take many different forms. And again, it's just there has to be some way to prevent shame from being triggered, because no one likes shame. And these tend to be the youngest parts of us, like the parts that started when we were very young. So that's the critic side. Just to pause for a second to mention, equal and opposite to the critic, or whatever that kind of manager is, you have another escape part, like the what IFS calls the firefighter. It's the part that will kick into action if shame is really triggered. So one of the most common ways of that takes place is the distractor or relaxer. So there's a part that tries to give us permission to then let go of whatever the challenge was that was provoking shame, or to somehow escape it. Addictive behaviors are the strongest form of that. So where then people will have addictions. It's interesting, in IFS, addictions are not generally seen as problems with cravings. In a deeper way, they're problems with shame. And so they're ways of escaping or anesthetizing the emotion. So you have then these dual problems. You have a preventive part and an escape part. And what's interesting is each of them gets healed in a completely different way by the true self. The true self is simply our conscious, aware, fully embodied self. So it's us at our best. It's what is considered to be more right-brained. It's basically you when you are totally silent. If you can just be experiencing the world, experiencing the whole of your body, experiencing your breath, you know, just being in the present moment, that's true self. So from that position, then, you can learn to work with the critic and with the relaxer or distractor and get them to de-escalate. You can help to unburden them bit by bit by bit. And that's what it means to reintegrate them, where they're eventually just going to be part of how you handle these challenges, but in a constructive way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kevin, I think, well, we don't have too much time left, so I'm thinking it's going to be hard to summarize all of that, like how do you work with the parts and so forth. So maybe we can just give a little bit of a foretaste here and then cover it in a future episode. Sure. Too. I guess one immediate question I have is, maybe when people are used to self-examination or, you know, kind of reflecting on their own actions and what should I do in the future, kind of planning, thinking, it's more of an analysis mode. It's like reviewing mm-hmm. past actions, thinking, okay, planning, what can I do in the future? So it's just kind of you analyzing objective things and thinking. But here we're talking about taking, you know, looking at some friction in our lives, breaking it down into part, like, well, there are parts of us that are contributing to that. You have the exile part, the protector part, mm-hmm. the manager part. And then it's a different approach entirely, that you're kind of personifying these parts, and then you actually start a dialogue with them so that you can talk to them, right?
Yeah. And overall, the way that you do it is the shame itself as the emotion, that's the challenge. Okay. So that's the essential centerpiece of the challenge, is feeling the shame and being compassionate with the shame, to be able to innerly embrace it. The critic, or that function, whoever it is marked by an inability to see that challenge in a positive way. So you unburden your own inner critic by deliberately helping it to reframe the shame itself, so it can see this as there's a kind of growth that you can have that passes through the shame. It could be growth in some skill, like speaking a language that you're not good at, or dancing, or it could be growth in more important things like ideals and bonds, so that you're able to own the growth, to see, to own the possibility of it, so that the shame is not simply a negative kind of obstacle that you can't get past, but instead it's just the sign that you're on the road of growth. So you help the critic to actually re-experience or reframe the shame. And that can be done in advance. It can be done by thinking of past challenges that provoke shame. So it can be done anytime. In fact, anytime you reframe a challenge, you're making the critic's life a bit easier because you're showing that your self-model can be updated, that there's flexibility, that there's the potential for growth. So the more momentum of growth you have in your life by reframing challenges, in fact, the more quiet the critic gets. So that's why I think in optimal work, we are so interested in helping people reframe challenges. But this all comes together very nicely, where that's in fact how you unburden the critic in the deepest way. And the way you help the relaxer is through mindfulness, particularly of the shame itself. The relaxer parts, even addictive parts, are exquisitely sensitive to the feeling of the shame, but you can stabilize that sensitivity and turn it into a superpower by teaching them that this too, the shame itself, is the challenge to be mindfully welcomed and embraced. That kind of turns down the electric feeling that shame normally has for them, so they don't feel like they're shocked every time it comes. And they can learn to settle into the feeling of it. And that's how you unburden relaxers, by being mindful of the shame. But in fact, every time we practice mindfulness, we are in some way unburdening this part. And the better we get at actually growing through learning curves, getting through awkward moments, seeing the shame is just a sign of growth, that's where growth lies, the easier it is then for us to be mindful of it as well. So reframing and mindfulness and challenge, it's actually, optimal work is a way of doing IFS without even having to talk about parts or without having to talk about these kind of subpersonalities. In fact, we are helping people in the deepest way to grow.
So we, I guess just one last follow-up, and then I'll give you an opportunity to have the last word, and then we can see about covering this more in future episodes as well, because I think it's very interesting. And when you say reframing, helping the part reframe or being mindful helps the protector, the protector, then is it just the act of reframing just kind of takes care of it? Or because in IFS, it talks about having like a conversation and a kind of imagined conversation with the manager and the protector. Are you doing the reframing and mindfulness in the context of an imagined conversation with them? Like you're addressing the inner critic and giving it a name and imagining it as a person or as a kind of being? Or is it just, you can just do the reframing and mindfulness and that takes care of it?
But what IFS does is it gives a way of living ideals inwardly. So you start thinking like, how can I relate to my inner critic in a new way? And above all, it means compassion. How can I respond more compassionately to the inner critic, even when it's at its most bitter criticizing? You know, and you start to learn how to pour in a sense of love and compassion into the critic itself until you get it to the point where it can trust you more. And that you're taking, and what you do is you help it to see this challenge, whatever it might be. Maybe it's this presentation you have to give coming up and it's worried about it. You help it to see, no, this is going to be good for us. We can grow here. Critics, like all parts, are left brain models that our brain comes up with to give us patterns of acting in the face of challenge. These left brain models, they almost, because the left brain is so smart, they have like a sub-personality, so you can talk to them sometimes. You can interact with them. But all of that is basically trying to reunite the left and the right hemispheres. What the left brain cannot do is reframe or be mindful or see these challenges in a good light. Like I think the left brain is more about getting things done as efficiently as possible with using these models. And so it's not good at updating its own models. That's why the right brain is there. So every time you start to let a challenge bring out something new in you, approach this in a new way. In fact, I think all of the left brain models are just updated. So you can do it deliberately, imaginatively, have conversations with parts, or you can just stay focused on the challenge that you're really facing and be creative about letting it bring out something new in you. Either way, you're going to have, I think, this kind of solid growth. But if a part is particularly stuck, or particularly bitter, particularly hurt, then doing direct compassion work with that part, in fact, can be can lighten the burden even in a very short amount of time.
Wonderful. Hey, Kevin, that's all I got for you today.
All right, Shreve, great questions. Thanks.
I think we're out of time, so we'll be back next week.
It's a big topic. Hopefully
we'll be able to give it the treatment it deserves.
Great.
All right. See you, Kevin.
See ya.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. If you enjoyed our conversation and you're looking for more in-depth guidance, check out optimalwork.com, our platform of content, tools, and exercises that will help you thrive at work and beyond. See you next week.